You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM, all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio at every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as TV on both Dish Network and DirecTV and cable systems nationwide by the Free Speech TV Network. Well, the president gave a great speech today. I realize that, you know, sometimes that's a setup for a criticism and sometimes it's a setup for praise. It's a little bit of both. We'll get into that as we go on. Daryl Issa has been outed as a serial liar by Elijah Cummings. It's really quite spectacular. We'll get into that as we go through the day. And Japan is discovering highly toxic strontium 90 in the groundwater in Fukushima. This is what Kevin Camps was warning us about. Kevin will be with us in the third hour of the program, what he was warning us about a year ago, predicting, basically. So, and there's a lot of other stuff going on in the news that we will get to. But first, we're number 27. We're number 27. How cool is that? When you look at the 34 richest countries in the world, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD countries, and you look at the relative wealth of their middle classes, we're number 27. You thought we were number one? You thought we had the strongest middle class in the world? Well, we did before Reagan, but we don't anymore. 32 years of Reaganomics, we're now number 27. Austin Peterson is on the line. He's the director of production over at FreedomWorks, freedomworks.org, the website. And Austin, here we go. To 32 years of Reaganomics, 32 years of neo-libertarian philosophy. I mean, pure libertarianism is called feudalism. We haven't completely gotten there, but we're moving in that direction. And this is what it brings us.
Not necessarily. I mean, if you think about it, look at the countries that are above us. Who wants to live in Cyprus, Kuwait, or Qatar?
You ever been to Cyprus?
Cyprus isn't bad, but they're not doing very well with their currency right now. They've got a big problem, but the problem is not with the distribution of wealth. The problem is who has access to the wealth.
No, the problem. The problem Cyprus has is that they have an economy dependent upon banksters. You know, their entire economy is based on hiding banking things, and that's like not good.
It's not about hiding banking things. It's about devaluation of the currency and non-transparency of their banking system.
Yeah.
You see, people all over the world have been fooled that they need a central bank in order to manage their money supply. But what happens is that when you give the banks control of the money supply, you see what they do time and time again.
But Cyprus is at the bottom of the pile with us in Kuwait. Australia is at the top.
And it's
Japan's at the top. Italy's at the top.
Central
Belgium's
banks.
At the top.
But
Italy and Belgium don't even have a central bank.
But Japan is not the beacon of innovation that they used to be because of their central banks. You remember during the boom time of the 1980s, the Reaganomics that you so despise, there was a great inflationary period that happened in Japan. And what happened was when those banks finally collapsed because of the weight, they went in and they zombified those banks by bailing them out. And we're doing the same thing here in the United States. I mean, I would rather live in the United States than Japan, because at least we have innovation here in the United States. But if you want to talk about wealth stratification, you have to look at the monetary policy of these countries.
No, you don't.
And I think this is where you and I can actually agree,
Tom.
It does, because what happens is that the middle class has to pay a higher percentage of their income into necessities. The richer people who don't care about inflation, because the middle class, they don't have to spend as much money on their...
We don't have inflation right now, Austin. This is what you're suggesting is that our middle class has been wiped out by 32 years of Reaganomics because basically our currency has been deflated. When in fact, you know, the top 1% are doing just fine. In fact, the top 20% are doing just fine.
But Tom, you rail against the financial elite and you rail against banksters, and then you say that there's no inflation when you know for a fact that goods like gasoline and milk and other essential items that people have to buy have been rising at a rate of 5 to 8%. So if you say there's no inflation, you're carrying the government's
Austin,
water because they're saying
these are not
no
things unique to the United States.
They're not unique to the United States.
And therefore, that's not why we're number 27 in the world. We're number 27 in the world because it used to be that the wealthy people in America earned about 30 times what the average worker did. The CEOs earned about 30 times what the average worker did. And the reason that they didn't earn more than 30 times was because when you hit 30 times the average worker's salary, then a 74% income tax rate kicked in and people didn't want to pay that. And so they just said, you know, I'll just settle for $3 million a year income. That's enough. I mean, that's what CEOs used to make. Lee Iacocca famously made, you know, a dollar a year for 1 year and then $1 million a year after that. George Romney turned down a bonus.
The problem is that if you're looking at wealth disparity, you're forgetting about class mobility. And so you're assuming that people who are the haves versus the have-nots are always the haves. And what happens is
well, increasingly
people,
they are
some
in the United
people,
States because we have people, drastically since Reagan reduced social mobility.
No, we have more social mobility than we had since Ronald Reagan.
We
and
do
the
not.
The issue is, if you have a large
there are absolute
wealth,
measurements of that, Austin.
People, the same people don't always
social mobility is down in the United States. In fact, the United States and the UK of the 34 OECD countries, the United States, the United Kingdom, and Singapore are the three worst.
Well, what you want to do is you want to talk about what is wealth stratification. And if certain people in certain countries are closer to the rich, then what would it matter if you're living in a poor country?
Wealth stratification is a function of taxes.
No, it's wealth stratification is a function of monetary policy.
No, it's a function of how money is distributed in the society. And the major variable that determines how money is distributed in a society is taxation.
Tom, I don't understand how it is that you can rail against the banksters and then go ahead and spew their propaganda by saying that there's no inflation. You sit there and you say that you're a champion of the people,
you're going back to a tiny slice and arguably a straw man argument.
About right now, I'm surprised it didn't come from a meeting from Barack Obama right now because Ben Bernanke loves this. You know, these are their talking points.
Are you trying to tell me that by cutting taxes from 74% down to 28%, for people making over $3 million a year on their $3 million and first dollar, mm-hmm. and going from CEOs making 30 times what the average worker makes to making 600 times what the average worker makes, that had no impact on the fact that our middle class has gone from being the strongest in the world before Reagan to number 27 out of the 34 richest countries now?
No, what I'm saying is that the rich people in this country are going to hire less people and there's going to be less of a middle class because there is no
economic policy.
You're not talking economics, Tom. You're just saying that
rich people don't hire people because of how much money they have. They hire people businesses.
You don't have any
because there's demand for their goods or services. If you're talking about rich people who are business owners.
Tom, economics is a social science, okay? It's not a perfect science. It's not mathematics. You can't just say, okay, well, these people have a lot of money, so we're just going to take it from them and then give to other people. That's
sure
not economics.
Can.
That's just theft and communism.
No, that's neither theft nor communism. That is called progressive taxation. And all the other countries in the world that have stronger middle classes than us, like Austria and Australia and Canada and France and Norway and Finland and Great mm-hmm. Britain and Iceland and Belgium and Italy and Japan and Luxembourg, they all have higher tax rates on the very rich than we do.
The middle class needs, why would the middle class want to stay middle class? Nobody wants to stay middle class. So why are we trying to take
actually,
middle
my,
class?
My dad was
Benjamin
very happy
Franklin
to be middle class. I think the vast majority of the middle class would love to be in the middle class.
We should inspire the middle class to be the higher class. We want people to go off and be rich people, Tom.
You're selling snake oil, Oscar. Are you telling me that 100% of Americans can become billionaires?
I'm telling you that.
Or should.
No, of course not. That's utopian, Tom. That's what communists
believe. No, it's silly. That's why when you peddle it, it sounds silly.
Libertarians understand that economics, the way the free market works, is that there will be a simple stratification of wealth, but that a rising tide lifts all boats.
Well, it's a nice slogan, and I suppose it works in a marina. But I don't think, Reagan has demonstrated it doesn't work here. Anyway, Austin Peterson, you can read all about it at freedomworks.org. Thanks for being with us, Austin. Good talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We're number 27. I'll break down for you exactly why and how right after this. Right, here's an interesting paper. This is from Brookings. Brookings Papers on Economic Activity. The headline, the title of it, is Rising Inequality, Transitory or Permanent? New Evidence from a Panel of U.S. Tax Returns. This is, you know, this is an academic paper, so it sounds like an academic paper. And from the article about it over at brookings.edu, it says, in rising inequality, transitory or permanent, in this paper, two people from the Federal Reserve Board, Vasia Panossi and Ivan Vidangos of the Federal Reserve Board, Shanti Raman of the U.S. Treasury Department, Jason DeBacker of Middle Tennessee State University, and Bradley Heim of Indiana University used new data to closely examine inequality, finding an increase in permanent inequality. The advantage to becoming permanently better off, while the disadvantage to become permanently worse off. And they said that this greater disparity in families' well-being is unlikely to reverse, whereas transitory inequality, year-to-year income variability, would imply greater income mobility. That ain't happening so much. In other words, income inequality in the United States, we're number 27, is here and is here for a good long time. Get used to it. Get ready. And in this, this is just a brilliant piece over at Alternet. Big lie. America doesn't have richest number one in middle class in the world. We're ranked number 27. Les Leopold wrote it, who's been a guest on this program many times. And he lays out why. In fact, he asks rhetorically why. And he says, here's a starter list. We don't have real universal health care. So, you know, the middle class is paying their health care costs. And even if you have insurance, you're paying twice as much for your health care as anybody else in any other industrialized country does. Even though they pay for theirs through taxes, they're still paying for it, obviously. But they're paying half as much. So you and I are paying an average of, you know, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 a year for health care, for health insurance. And everybody else in the world is paying an average of $4,000 to $5,000 a year for health insurance, because other countries don't have people like Stephen Jay Hemsley, the CEO of United Healthcare, who has taken over $1 billion out of that company. Or his predecessor, Dollar Bill McGuire, who took $1.7 billion out of United Healthcare. They don't have companies like United Healthcare with over 100 executives making over $1 million a year. They don't. It's just, you know, blah, 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 blah. They don't have for-profit leeches fastened to the body politic, or to the body, what's the old word for citizenry? There's a bunch of them. I guess the captcha, in any case, they don't have for-profit corporations fastened to all of us. Sucking this right. Number one, no universal health care. Number two, weak labor laws. Union representation is less than 7% in the private sector in the United States. In most of these other countries, it's anywhere from 30 to 90%. Number three, our minimum wage is pathetic. $7.25 an hour. It's, you know, there are a few places in the United States where you might be able to live on that. But most of the country, no, it's a real challenge. And that puts downward pressure, Les Leopold notes, on the wages of all working people. Number four, Wall Street is out of control. I think Austin and I can even agree on that one. Number five, higher education is throwing our kids into debt. Let me add, when Reagan came into office and began his war on education, the Reagan administration, over the 8 years that he was in there, they cut $17 billion out of the Education Department's budget. William Bennett, the guy who campaigned on killing the Education Department, who Ronald Reagan put in charge of the Education Department. When Reagan came into office, about 80% of all tuition in the country was paid for either by the college or by the state or by the federal government. And so people could go to college relatively cheaply. You could work a summer job and earn enough money, save up enough money to pay for your tuition for the three quarters of the year that wasn't the summer. And you could, you know, do that for 4 years and graduate with a college degree and no debt. Prior to 1980, and most people did. I didn't complete college, but when I was going to college back in the late 60s and early 70s, I frankly didn't know anybody who had a student loan, with one exception, a friend of mine who was in medical school. He was in the osteopathic school at MSU, which is, you know, a little more expensive. But I, you know, student loans back in the 60s and 70s, people were like, what's that? I mean, they were available, but who needed it? My wife put herself through college working as a waitress at Howard Johnson's. I pumped gas. I worked as a DJ. I washed dishes at Bob's Big Boy. I mean, you could put yourself through college doing those things back then. Now, not so much. Instead of 80% of the tuition being paid for by governments or the universities, only about 22% of tuition is paid for by that. And about 80%, 70, 75 to 80%, is paid for by the students themselves. And in order to pay for that, of course, they've got to go out and borrow that money. And by the way, spoiler alert here, July 1st, unless the Republicans in Congress act, the interest rate on those loans is going to go from 3.2% to 3.4% to 6.8%. It's going to double on over $1 trillion in student loans, or on some significant portion of it, over $1 trillion in student loans. Another reason why our middle class is number 27, our tax code favors the rich, not the middle class. The middle class are paying a larger proportion of their income in taxes than rich people do. It's just that simple. Mitt Romney pays a lower tax rate than his secretary does, just like the same with Warren Buffett. Probably true of Bill Gates. You know, it's really interesting. Bill Gates actually, you know what, he donated all that money to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and now they're doing all this wonderful stuff around the world, vaccinating people and whatnot. He actually made a profit on that donation because of the tax law. It actually made him money. It didn't lose him money. And then, of course, big money dominates the media, so you don't hear stories like the one I'm sharing with you right now in any corporate-owned venue. Fortunately, this is a Hartman-owned venue.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean that literally. Louise and I own this show, 100% of it. We'll be back 27 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, man, it is incredible. I'm going to pick up your calls here in just a second, but first, Daryl Issa. This is so sad. Daryl Issa has, I mean, he has literally come out and said that there's Washington, D.C. involvement in this targeting Tea Party groups. Well, apparently what it was that somebody in the IRS office in Cincinnati contacted the Washington, D.C. IRS office and said, are we doing this right? And, you know, can we have some, is this consistent? You know, but there was no conspiracy. There was no there. There was no targeting. It was just, you know, here. So the question is, this is the, you know, the interrogation of this conservative Republican who came up with the idea of flagging groups for additional scrutiny based on their names, because their names may indicate that they're more interested in politics than social welfare. So if a group that is got a name, Johnson City Children's Fund comes through, it's probably not going to get flagged for double scrutiny. But if one comes by that says the Johnson City Tea Party that comes through, or for that matter, the Johnson Party raving communists, then it might well be flagged. I mean, it just makes sense. This is somebody, this is a conservative Republican bureaucrat in Cincinnati doing his job. He should be congratulated. He should be honored. So he's being interrogated here in IRS's, in Daryl Issa's little, you know, Daryl Issa, he wants to be Joe McCarthy so bad. But he's so bad at it. I mean, Ted Cruz at least is sort of good at it. At least with the public speech part. I've never seen Ted Cruz do an interrogation. Daryl Issa thinks he's got the interrogation part down. I guess between the two of them, they're trying to split Joe McCarthy's ghost. And neither one's doing a particularly good job. So, you know, Mr. Grand Theft Auto, Daryl Issa, says, so my question to you is, did blank This is, you know, apparently one of these people in D.C. ever give you any instructions on what to do with these cases? Answer, not to my knowledge. Did anyone else give you any instruction on what to do with these cases? Not to my knowledge. Did you ever get criteria to use in screening Tea Party cases? I never did get criteria to use. So you were never instructed to use anything different than what you and your screeners, than what you sent to blank. We never were instructed to use any criteria. What I provided a blank to send a blank were the issues that my screeners were seeing in the cases. Right. But we never had criteria. Yeah. Never had criteria. I mean, you know, the whole thing is a lie. But I absolutely, I'm telling you, this is how it works. I believe it was Goebbels who said this. I'm pretty sure. That if you tell a lie often enough and audaciously enough, people will begin to believe it. This lie, you know, another part of it, I keep hearing right-wing talk show hosts and Fox News, during this time, the commissioner of the IRS had was in the White House logs 137 times, or 127, whatever, over 100 times. Well, that's because there were all these appointments, there were all these meetings that mostly had to do with Obamacare. Because part of Obamacare is funded by changes in the tax code. So on a pro forma basis, whenever they put together a list of who should we invite to this meeting about putting together Obamacare, they would include the IRS commissioner or the head of the IRS. So that person was in those logs, but he only showed up, or she only showed up. I don't know who the person who is in charge of the IRS is, but frankly, but whoever the person in charge of the IRS is only showed up like, you know, 11, 12, 14 times, something like that during that period of time. And none of it had to do with the Tea Party. It was not over 100, as you know, Sean Hannity and his buddies would have you believe. Being in the logs and actually being in the White House are two completely different things. Being in the logs means if you show up, they let you in. This is mind-boggling. So, anyhow, we're number 27. Mike in Schererville, Indiana?
Close enough, Tom.
Okay, what's up, Mike?
Your first guest was talking about how the price of gas and the price of milk and all these other things are going up because of inflation. And he should know he should know better than anyone, because his boss was in Congress back when they changed the law. If you look at the price of gas and you look at the wholesale price of gas and what the price for a barrel of oil is, you'll go nuts trying to figure it out.
Right.
But last week when a gas out here was $4.45 a gallon, oil, the price of a barrel of oil was still in the $90 range, not in the $140 range the first time we went to $4.15 a gallon.
Right.
And the wholesale price is less than half of what we're paying at the pump.
Right. So the reason that there are wild fluctuations in food prices and in fuel prices is because both are commodities that are aggressively traded by banksters.
Right. So it's not inflation that's got everything going up. It's Wall Street.
Yeah, it's speculation. You're absolutely right, Mike. Thank you very much for calling and making that point. It's an important point that needed to be made. And I wish I'd made it during the debate. Sabrina, we have the smartest listeners on earth, I got to tell you. Sabrina in McKinney, Texas. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for I love your show, Tom.
Thanks, Sabrina.
And you mentioned earlier about the health care costs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a licensed insurance agent. And, you know, what I've found is that the monthly premiums that people are paying, the high premiums that you're paying,
mm-hmm.
most folks are not going to the doctor on a regular basis. Most of that premium is going to the pockets of the billionaires that have taken over the insurance industry, healthcare insurance. It's going directly to their pockets. You still have I've been looking at whether I was going to sell healthcare under the new healthcare law. They're paying agents a whole lot less money if we do sell it because it's become mandatory.
Mm-hmm.
And then two, insurance companies are going to, you'll have high deductibles, like $10,000 deductibles,
mm-hmm.
So that makes your monthly premium go down.
Right.
But I'd say a family of four, including your children, each person in the family will have a $10,000 deductible to satisfy before the insurance company kicks in to pay.
Wow.
So that's something to think about, too. And then you've got states, especially Texas, where I am, where your governor is not going to help you to offset some of the cost by helping by allowing people to enroll in Medicaid.
Right, by taking that Medicaid money from the federal government.
Yeah, so people are going to be stuck with those high costs in those places.
Yep.
Another thing, too, is that as an insurance agent, I've been in insurance practically my whole life. I've been licensed since 1986. Mm-hmm. But I've noticed what they started doing with us is we're licensed through the state. We have to have continuing education.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of these companies that pay more, example, Liberty Mutual, you have to take an assessment test. And I've actually had to brush up on algebra, which I never have to use selling insurance,
yeah,
to be able to get a job in those companies. And that's to weed out certain people, and I haven't figured that part out yet, but they do ask what your race is. So there's a whole lot going on with that, and I just want people to know, think about every time you've got people paying as much as $800 a month for their health care.
Yeah.
Well, most of that is going to the billionaires, so think about that.
There you go.
And there's got to be something that we can do about this because it's absolutely ridiculous.
Well, the good news, what we can do about it, Sabrina, thank you. You've identified a real problem, and that is that even with Obamacare, it's still being run through private for-profit corporations who are going to figure out a way to make sure that they get the billions and we get stuck with the bill. But the good news is that there is a provision in Obamacare that says come 2016, any state that wants to create its own program of any kind can do so and opt out of Obamacare as long as everybody in the state is insured. And the state of Vermont has already passed legislation and is putting into place right now a single-payer program that they're going to roll out then. And the state of Montana is talking about it very seriously. Brian Schweitzer there. So there are a lot of good possibilities coming down the road. And I think that it's going to be a very positive thing. I think that the first state that does a good, solid, serious single-payer plan, and the whole Obamacare insurance exchanges is helping set up the infrastructure for that, by the way. First state that does that is going to be like Saskatchewan in Canada back in the 50s or 60s. And every other state is going to look at them and say, wow, your health care costs are half of what they were and you're delivering a better outcome. We got to do what you're doing. And that's how it's spread across Canada. And it's still operated by the individual states across Canada. And I think it'll spread across the United States the same way. You think it's possible?
Well, I certainly hope so.
Yeah, me too.
I really do.
Me too. Sabrina, thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. Thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV in McKinney, Texas. And we will be right back. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Poor Daryl Munson. Except for the fact that he's the second richest guy in Congress. I guess he can find somebody to... He can pay somebody to tell him how brilliant he is. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
He just doesn't quite have that Joe McCarthy snarl. I mean, he's trying, but not quite. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, here we are, epilogue. This, somebody called and asked about William Casey, Bill Casey. Bill Casey was the director of the CIA. And he was also the head of the Reagan-Bush campaign in 1980 when they cut a deal. According to Bonnie Sauter, former Iranian president Bonnie Sauter, who ran for election in 1980 on the platform in Iran, ran for president on the platform of I'm going to release the hostages, won overwhelmingly, was installed as president in the fall of 1980 and went to the Ayatollahs and said, okay, I'm going to release the hostages now. And they said, no, you're not. We cut a deal with the Reagan campaign, and you have to hold those hostages until Ronald Reagan's sworn into office. And they did. They released them the moment that Reagan put his hand in the Bible. So here is the from the epilogue of Barbara Honegger's book. I'll just read it to you. It's just one paragraph. Dead, William Casey, CIA director, who reportedly attended meetings in Paris, France on October 19 and 20, 1980, with Iranian officials and agents of French intelligence to arrange an arms for hostages delay deal with Iran. The morning of his first scheduled under oath testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee on the secret Iran initiative, he was struck by seizures in his CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, and underwent speech incapacitating left brain surgery shortly thereafter. Had he lived to testify, according to lifelong friend and lawyer counsel Milton Gould, Casey would have told the, quote, entire truth, end quote. He died on May 6, 1987. So, there you go. It's from October Surprise by Barbara Honegger. Andrew in Lawton, Oklahoma. Hey, Andrew, you want to disagree with me?
Well, I don't know much about that, but...
It says you want to disagree about our being not the reason why we're number 27. Our middle class is the 27th best in the world rather than the first.
Well, that is in terms of wealth.
Pardon?
Okay, that's in terms of wealth distribution.
No, it's in terms of wealth. It's in terms of how much they own, not how much they make, but how much they own, what their wealth is. Yeah.
You know, typically speaking, the study of human action is a priori, but you could do a study and take pies to kids in a grade school and give one kid a great big pie and another kid a pie that's a little bit bigger. And then in the next class over, take a great big pie and an even bigger pie. The kid with the great big pie, you know what? He's not going to care. It may or may not affect him psychologically, but he is just as full. It's the same size pie, right?
I don't understand what you're saying. What's the point?
You're not following me.
Well, actually, let me just toss a couple numbers at you, and you can tell me if this makes any sense, okay? These are the actual numbers. And we're talking just about the middle class. We're talking about not the top 20%, not the bottom 20%. We're talking about the middle three-fifths, okay? The middle class in the world, the middle three-fifths of any country. The median wealth in Australia for that middle class, the average Australian family in the middle class, has $193,650 worth of wealth. Probably most of it is in their home or in their car, but who knows where it is. But it's $193,000. The average middle-class family in Japan has $141,000 worth of wealth. The average middle-class family in Italy has $123,000 worth of wealth. In Belgium, it's $119,000. In Great Britain, it's $115,000. In Iceland, it's $95,000. In Singapore, it's $95,000. In Switzerland, it's $87,000. In Austria, it's $81,000. In Canada, it's $81,000. In France, it's $81,000. In Norway, it's $79,000. You know what it is in the United States?
What is it?
$38,786.
We have a debt problem, don't we?
This is wealth. This is wealth. This is how much the average family owns. This is when you take, what is your wealth? You take the value of everything you have and you subtract from it everything you owe. So if you've got a $300,000 house and you owe $200,000 on it, you got $100,000 worth of wealth in your house. On the other hand, if you've got a $20,000 credit card bill on top of that, now you've got $80,000 worth of wealth. If you got a $50,000 student loan on top of that, now you've got $20,000 worth of wealth or $30,000, and like that. And in Australia, it's $193,000, and in the United States, it's $38,000.
Right.
That's pretty pathetic.
So what your concern is not the wealth, the discrepancy in the wealth distribution, but how do we accumulate more wealth? How can we accumulate more wealth?
But see, the two are tied together. In Australia, when you start making more than $2 or $3 million a year, they start taxing you at well over 50%. The same is true of Luxembourg and Japan and Italy and Belgium and it was in Great Britain until recently. in Iceland, Singapore, Switzerland, Austria, all those other countries, really, really rich people are taxed at a fairly high rate, so they don't take high salaries. Instead, they pay their workers good salaries.
When Reagan came along
and dropped taxes on the rich in the United States from 74% down to 28%, that's when the United States started collapsing. We used to be up there with Australia and Luxembourg.
First of all, I mean, I'll bash on Reagan. I'm not a fan. Truth is, he raised taxes six times in the 8 years that he was president.
I think it was more than that. I think it was more like, 16 or 18, but whatever. Yes, he did raise taxes a number of times. He doubled the taxes on working class people by doubling the payroll tax.
Right. So.
But he cut taxes on rich people, and that's why the Republicans deify him.
Well, I'm not a Republican, and to be fair, I think that a lot of the stuff that we're talking about, it's not political. It's economic. You can take a vote and say, how many people want the poor to be homeless and go hungry? Nobody's going to vote for that. We all want to take care of people.
It is political, Andrew, because what you find is that Democrats vote for high taxes on rich people and redistribution of income, that is things like Social Security and, social safety net programs for poor people. And Republicans say, no, screw the poor people. They're trying to cut $22 billion with a B out of the food stamps program in the House of Representatives. And the Democrats only want to cut $4 billion. It's like, there is a political difference, and it does echo down to the middle class.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And are nonviolent protesters now labeled terrorists? Really? Corporations are trying to use the Patriot Act in ways that have nothing to do with Osama bin Laden, because the Patriot Act gives transnational corporations the power to snuff out the activism of anybody who opposes them. Terrorism, as it is commonly considered, is the use of violence against civilians to achieve any number of political ends. The destruction of the federal government, the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the restoration of a caliphate. If you try to kill people or succeed in killing people for a political purpose, you're a terrorist. If you blow up the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building and kill 168 civilians like Tim McVeigh, you've committed an act of terrorism. Seems pretty self-explanatory, right? Well, not according to TransCanada Corp, the Canadian-owned energy conglomerate that is the backer of the Keystone XL pipeline extension. A new set of documents obtained by a progressive group, it's called Bold Nebraska, shows that this foreign corporation is encouraging American law enforcement agencies to treat anti-pipeline protesters as if they were terrorists. Yes, terrorists. The documents, which Bold Nebraska got a hold of through a FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act request, were part of a briefing given to Nebraska law enforcement agents about the, quote, emerging threat, end quote, of groups like Tar Sands Blockade and Rainforest Action. And what are the terrorist activities that TransCanada is so concerned about? They include things like monkey wrenching, tree sitting, and tying yourself to a construction vehicle with a device called a dragon lock. If this seems familiar, it should, because what groups like Tar Sands Blockade are engaging in is classic civil disobedience. This is not terrorism, but this foreign corporation, TransCanada, wants American law enforcement agents to start looking at it like it is. By far the most damning document obtained by Bold Nebraska urges Nebraska authorities to consider using, quote, state or federal anti-terrorism laws prohibiting sabotage or terroristic acts against critical infrastructures, end quote. In other words, TransCanada thinks American police should treat blockading construction vehicles just like blowing up a bus in downtown D.C. And I would add, they think that, doing anything to harm a pipeline that's taking oil down to the Gulf Coast so it can be refined and exported is somehow critical infrastructure. I don't see how you can justify that definition. Now, on the other hand, if a group of tar sands blockades activists were, in fact, planning to, like, bomb TransCanada's Calgary, Alberta headquarters or assassinate its CEO, God forbid, then they would absolutely be terrorists. But right now, they're just protesters or vandals and should not be treated as terrorists. So what makes TransCanada think it can get the American police to treat people sitting in trees like Mohammed Atta? The Patriot Act. The U.S. legal code definition of terrorism was expanded to include a new meaning of domestic terrorism by Congress in 2001. This new definition considers domestic terrorism as, quote, activities that involve acts of dangerous, that involve acts dangerous to human life that are a violation of the criminal laws of the United States or of any state, semicolon, appear to be intended to intimidate or coerce a civilian population, semicolon. I don't see the word corporation in there. To influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion, semicolon. Or to affect the conduct of a government by mass destruction, comma, assassination, comma, or kidnapping, semicolon. And occur primarily within the territorial jurisdiction of the United States. Period, end of sentence. According to the ACLU, this definition, this is a verbatim quote from the ACLU, quote, this definition is broad enough to accompany the activities of prominent activists, campaigns, and organizations, end quote. In other words, given the right lawyer, TransCanada can convince a federal judge that monkey wrenching or tying oneself to a construction vehicle is dangerous to human life and intended to intimidate a civilian population. We already know, thanks to Edward Snowden, that our government has used the broad powers of the Patriot Act to amass a large collection of American citizens' telephone records, something that even one of its authors, Republican Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner, has said goes beyond what he thinks was its original intent. Do we really want to give corporations this sort of power to misuse our criminal justice system? Our founders envisioned a society in which all were held accountable to and by the law, not a society in which vague and overly broad statutes empower foreign private corporations to persecute American activists. So, bottom line, let's repeal the Patriot Act, not only to preserve our civil liberties, and not only to protect our democratic republic from the predation of transnational corporations, but to protect our right to protest. This seems just as American as apple pie. Tell me something that's more American as apple pie than protesting. We started as a protesting nation. In fact, we started as a protesting nation made up of people who were protesting religion. The Protestants. Think of that word. Protestant. It's actually normally pronounced as Protestant. In the early days of the Republic, there were very few Catholics, very few Jews, mostly Protestants and atheists or deists or Quakers. People who were protesting the religious order. It's like, so that we were protesting religion. The protesters came here. I mean, religion in Europe. Followers of Martin Luther, followers of Henry VIII, whatever. Followers of Oliver Cromwell. Came here. And then started protesting England's economic policies via the British East India Company. And then started protesting England's political policies. And then, I mean, this is where it gets really amazing. You know, TransCanada is saying if these guys commit, say, even a small act of vandalism, that is terrorism. What was the Boston Tea Party? Seriously. They threw, in today's dollars, $1 million worth of tea into the Boston Harbor. And the British government overreacted. They passed the Boston Ports Act saying that if the city of Boston did not reimburse the British East India Corporation $1 million in today's dollars, back in those days it was something like 7,800 pounds or whatever, but that if they didn't reimburse them, that, you know, they were going to seal off the Boston port. And Boston said, pfft. And so they sealed off the Boston port, and boom, the American Revolution was off and running, in part. I mean, there were a few other intervening incidents, you know, the Boston Massacre and the Lexington Concord and this, that, the other thing. But it really started there in the late fall, early winter of 1773 with a protest. An act of vandalism against a transnational corporation. Now, I'm not an advocate of, nor am I supporting vandalism. But if somebody's going to commit vandalism, they should be prosecuted as a vandal, not as a terrorist. And if somebody is going to simply protest, then they should be prosecuted for civil disobedience, for protesting, not as a terrorist. Can you imagine if Martin Luther King had been labeled a terrorist?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I mean, I suppose there were people of his day who tried to call him that, but the fact of the matter is that the terrorists of that day were the Ku Klux Klan. They were actually killing people. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, our average middle-class American family has $38,000 in wealth. Now, this is the middle class. This is the average family who's making around $45,000 a year when you add up the salaries of everybody in the family working as many jobs as they're working. They've got about $38,000 in the equity in their home, in their checking account, in the value of their car, and you add it all together and, you know, that's what they got, $38,000. The average middle-class family in Australia, where rich people pay such high taxes that Rupert Murdoch left the country and came here. The average middle-class family in Australia has $193,000 in wealth. In Japan, it's $141,000. In Italy, it's $123,000. It's amazing. Okay, so we've got that. Our middle class is melting down. We have then, at the same time, transnational corporations like TransCanada, which wants to make money taking toxic bituminous slurry and pumping it down an oil pipeline to the southern coast. By the way, yesterday I said that up in Alberta there was an oil spill and a toxic brine spill, a water spill, and I was wrong. The toxic water spill has killed off about 1,000 acres of trees and plants. It's basically pouring salt into the ground. The article that I read said this follows several oil spills in Alberta in the past month, and so but there's nothing in the last few days. So let me correct myself. This was just a spill of a couple million gallons of toxic water that they use to get out the oil. But in any case, we've got this corporation, this Canadian corporation, coming into the United States and trying to tell our law enforcement agency that people who are protesting should be dealt with as if they were terrorists, at the same time that our middle class is collapsing. At the same time that the most important thing the House of Representatives could do yesterday is defy the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision. Now, think what you want about abortion. The question you have to ask yourself isn't, you know, was that a good bill or a bad bill? The question you have to ask yourself is, knowing that that bill will not make it through the Senate and that the president has already said he would veto if it got to the White House, and knowing that that bill will have absolutely nothing to do with job creation or the strength of the middle class, why are the Republicans doing that in the House of Representatives instead of passing legislation that takes away tax breaks for corporations that ship our jobs overseas? For example, or creating jobs here in the United States, or doing something about a looming, you know, carbon crisis. Bill McKibben has a new piece in the Rolling Stone, by the way, talking about this stuff. It's really worth checking out. So these, I think, are really the important issues of our day. And the Republicans, I mean, we all know the answer. The answer goes back to January 20th, 2009, the night of the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated. I was here in Washington, D.C. I stood probably 60 yards away from Barack Obama as he was sworn in. I was the closest member of the press to the president as he was sworn in. It was really kind of cool. Ellen Ratner got us, you know, the Talk Radio News Service got us in the international press space right there on the same level as the president. And I could have just walked around the corner and shook his hand if the two burly Secret Service guys had let me. Not that I was inclined to, but... And I was standing, you know, 70 feet away or 100 feet away from George W. Bush was sitting behind him, and he was making these awful faces and doing these flipper gestures, you know, these sarcastic applause lines. I was sure that that was going to be the big story the next day. Turned out it wasn't. So, anyhow, we've got this disaster, and it goes back to that day. Actually, the night of that day. The night of that day. After Obama was sworn in the caucus room restaurant here in Washington, D.C., there was a group of about 15 Republicans who got together and plotted to bring down the Obama presidency. They used the Taliban as their model, according to one of the Republicans who was there. He said this publicly later. And that what they swore to do was block anything. Now keep in mind, on that day, we were losing 700,000 jobs a month. They blocked to do anything. They swore an oath to each other to block anything that would improve the economy, help America, and thus make the Obama presidency look successful. And for a couple of weeks there, they were successful. And then Teddy Kennedy died, and I don't remember the exact sequence of events, but there was a few weeks, you know, the first few weeks of the Obama presidency, he did not have a filibuster-proof Senate, so they were able to block him in the Senate, even when good legislation came out of the House. And then there was a little window of about, as I recall, eight weeks to 11 weeks, something like that, just a couple of months, where by one vote, they could actually get stuff done, and they got a lot done. And then Scott Brown got appointed, and boom, they lost their ability to filibuster or to block filibusters by the Republicans. And for the last 5 years, the Republicans have blocked every significant effort by this administration to strengthen the American middle class, which on average owns $38,000 worth of wealth. Whereas the average Australian middle-class family owns $193,000 worth of wealth. And the Republicans like it this way. Libertarianism. Yes. You know what libertarianism is called? I mean, we've tried it before. It's called feudalism.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Kings and queens, lords and ladies, all that stuff. Yeah, that's libertarianism. We'll be back 27 minutes past the hour. Back with your calls and my thoughts. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And amazing. Jeff, hang on just a second here. Jeff in Sherman Oaks, California. You wanted to talk about the IRS?
I say God bless the IRS, and I never thought I'd say that.
Really?
Really. I'm telling all my friends, you know, it's their duty to expose these phony political organizations that are hiding under the tax-exempt status.
Yeah.
And
it's their job description, actually.
Yes. And even things like the Church of Scientology, that literally means the study of science. How can they pull that over on the IRS? I'm so happy that we're seeing the faces of the IRS on television so we can judge as to how much common sense they have.
Well, with the Church of Scientology, there is a bunch of belief stuff. You know, the people from the planet Xenu seeded, or Thetans or whatever, seeded the planet Earth 10,000 years ago with humans, and eventually the last clear human, or the, you know, when a certain threshold of humans become clear, then the spaceship's going to come back and take it. I mean, that's the after you pay your $100,000 or whatever it is, you know, for years and years and years, and finally reach the highest level of Scientology. My understanding is that's like the highest secret you learn. So that kind of sounds like a religion to me.
I have faith, or a science fiction story. Too. I have faith in the IRS, and if they can put Karl Rove in jail, I'm all for them.
Yeah.
But let me say something. I'm a proud liberal, have been. I was born in 1943, been a liberal all my, ever since I can remember. But I'm so ashamed of our party. We don't know how to fight. We're cowards. And yet we're fighting people who have no intent of doing anything good for this country, and yet they have nerves of steel. And we don't understand that Jimmy Carter's still alive. Yes, Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush stole that election. And yes, they got away with it, and they took off the solar panels off the White House 40 years ago, when we could have been 40 years ahead of our energy crisis that we're seeing today. And BP wouldn't be on television every 20 minutes acting like they're the biggest American enterprise in America,
right,
doing the right thing, and every employee in BP is the happiest person in the world. I'm from Louisiana, and that kind of stuff makes me sick. But Jimmy Carter would have never let that happen. Jimmy Carter had the policy that Reagan and Bush reversed, just like George W. Bush and Dick Cheney reversed everything Bill Clinton did. And Al Gore would have gone after Osama bin Laden, just like Bill Clinton tried to, if he'd have gotten his chance. And we probably could have prevented 9/11. But when are people going to connect the dots and realize we're up against enemies, and every time they fight us, they're trying to stay out of jail for what they've done to us? So why don't we fight them and attack them? Why are we always on defense?
Yeah, Jeff, I think people are starting to realize that. The in the House of Representatives, in the last election, Democrats got 1.5 million more votes than Republicans. The only reason that John Boehner is the House Majority Leader, the Speaker of the House, rather than Nancy Pelosi, the only reason is because of gerrymandering in the states. The state legislatures that have been taken over by Republicans, Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, Indiana, they have only been taken over by Republicans because of the efforts of billionaires, the Koch brothers, Paul, what's the guy's name now who's funded the whole thing in North Carolina? There's this new billionaire, and it's being revealed, basically. It's all coming out. This one billionaire who basically has taken over the politics of the state. And so we're seeing states turned into basically feudal empires. And like I said, you know, these guys all call themselves libertarianism or libertarians. And libertarianism has been tried before. Europe existed under libertarianism for 1,000 years. It was called feudalism. And you know, property reigned above everything else. Private property, that was the religion of it. So, but I think the American people are getting it. They elected Obama because of his rhetoric, because he was saying the right things. We need him to do the right things. He, to some extent, he has. To some extent, he hasn't. To a large extent, the largest extent, he can't, because the Republicans have obstructed every attempt to do anything meaningful. We a million and a half more of us voted for Democrats than for Republicans in the House of Representatives. More of us voted for Democratic senators than Republican senators. So I think the American people have figured out what's going on. The question is, you know, how long is it going to take? How long is it going to take for there to be a large enough majority, a large enough supermajority, that a president can actually talk and act like Franklin Roosevelt, not just talk like him? But so, Jeff, I understand your frustration. We have to be the movement politics. We have to be the wind behind their back. We have to be pushing them. And we have to be supporting people who do speak out, like Peter DeFazio and Alan Grayson and Bernie Sanders and Sherrod Brown and Al Franken. I mean, there's some good people out there, Elizabeth Warren, good people in the House and Senate who are really fully deserving of our support. So, Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Catherine in Vista, California. Hey, Catherine, you live in Darrell Issa's district? Really?
Yes, I do. The 49th Congressional District in the state of California.
Oh, that's almost scary.
I wanted to give you, hi, Tom. This is the second or third time we've talked.
Mm-hmm.
I am so just like you. We're about the same age. I grew up, had similar experiences. I sit and listen. I work at home, and you're saying what's right in my mind. So I'm just good on you.
Thank you.
And I've adopted that phrase, by the way, from you. Thank you very much.
Sure. I got it in Australia. It's how Australians talk to each other.
Yeah.
And
cool.
I just liked it. I thought it was almost a blessing in addition to a congratulations.
Well, I find a lot of use for that term now. Mm-hmm. So it's a good thing. Anyway, I wanted to give you some information about Mr. Darrell Issa.
Okay.
I worked on Jerry Tailman's campaign, who was the Democratic contender against him in the last congressional race. Tailman got no funding whatsoever from the Democrats because they didn't think he had a rat's chance to get even close.
Right. Because Issa is himself.
How close he got, though.
Yeah, but Issa himself is a half a billionaire, so he can fund himself if he had to.
He got 41%, almost half. How
the Democrat did.
Yes.
That's pretty good.
With no funding except local donations and, you know, small things mm-hmm. like that. Issa did not campaign. He did not make one speech. He didn't send out anything except, well, maybe to his own Republican mm-hmm. mailing list. But he didn't meet with anybody. He wouldn't debate. He refused. He never does. He just is so cocky and arrogant and thinking that nothing can happen.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, 41%, that's almost half. I think he's out in the next election, especially if Jerry runs again. He hasn't said if he's going to.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, part of the reason I think Darrell Issa is working so hard right now to make a name for himself is because he knows he might be out, at least in the local elections, if he doesn't come up with something really amazing.
Yeah.
And I so agree with you about silly campaign against the president. He's got nothing to do with the IRS.
Yeah. Well, and Catherine, this demonstrates the wisdom of Howard Dean and the stupidity or lack of wisdom, let's say, of the people who followed him in running the Democratic Party. Howard Dean had this 50-state strategy. He said, you know, we're going to compete in every congressional district in the country. We're going to compete in every state in the country. We are going to compete. And Democrats won a lot of districts and a lot of states that they didn't expect to win, that they hadn't planned on winning, and they made a lot of inroads as a consequence of Dean's 50-state strategy. The Democrats stopped doing that after the election of Obama, and the Republicans picked the strategy up, and they've been doing it ever since. And I think that the Democrats need to go back to it. But that's very kind of inside the beltway wonky stuff. Catherine, thank you for the call, and thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. Bill in Chandler, Arizona. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You know, I don't disagree with your facts on middle class and wealth. I do disagree with your conclusions.
Okay.
Okay. Basically, and it all comes down to credit again, is that, you know, we're a creditor country and we are a creditor people. Everybody.
We're actually a debtor country right now. And
I'm sorry. That's what I mean. Debtor yeah. country, debtor people. Sorry. Mm-hmm. I had it backwards. You know, we go out in the middle class. The reason we don't have any net worth is because you buy a new car every 3 years. You buy a new cell phone every 3 years. You buy the biggest house you can afford for the payment. Everybody buys on payments.
But, you know, Bill, that was true 30 years ago, too. And when my dad died, his house was paid off. His car was paid off. He had a pension. He had Social Security. And he had just worked 40 years in a tool and die shop.
But you're proving my point. He had a house that was paid off. He had a car that was paid off. People didn't go out and buy a new car and lease it every 3 years.
Well, my dad did, actually. It was every 2 years he got a new car. Maybe it was every three years, but it was every 2 to 3 years. But he didn't lease them. He bought them.
Okay, he bought them and he owned them. So, you know, now
and he bought that house. He bought that house on a 30-year note in 1956, I think, as I recall. We moved
right,
into that house.
He didn't refi it when the value went up to go out and buy a dishwasher and new upgrades in the house.
No, he didn't.
You know, he may have upgraded the house, but he didn't buy a bigger house.
Yeah, so you're trying to blame the victims, is what I would suggest, Bill. And I'm not buying it, respectfully. I don't think that the middle class is responsible for the predicament that they're in. I think that they've been preyed upon by the banksters and by the political class. I refer you to this article over at Alternet. Check out alternet.org. I think you'll find it fascinating. Bill, thanks
for
the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And the middle class no longer has labor union representation. My dad worked in a union shop all those years. Yeah, that's gone by and large. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where if you give a goat, you can help a rescued slave. You'll receive a photo of your goat and the person you helped. And Ellen Ratner, the head of the Talk Radio News Service, is over in South Sudan right now taking pictures of people and goats. And Victoria, hey, how are you?
Hey, Tom. I'm good.
Good. So what's going on in the world today?
Well, I think the Senate Judiciary Committee got a little bit of a surprise today.
You mean Elijah Cummings' data dump?
No. This was Senator Chuck Grassley, ranking member, was questioning FBI Director Robert Mueller.
Uh-huh.
And Mueller said that, yes, actually, the FBI uses drones to watch specific targets within the United States occasionally, yes. Our footprint is very small. We have very few and have limited use. So after everybody had fallen off their chairs with shock,
yes,
he then said the FBI was in the, quote, initial stages of developing privacy guidelines for how the agency balances civil liberty concerns with security threats. In other words,
isn't that precious?
They don't have any.
Right. Isn't that precious?
Dianne Feinstein, chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, told him that she believes drones are the most dangerous threat to the privacy of Americans, particularly the use of drones by private companies. He sought to assure her that they're used very seldom used, generally used in a particular incident where you need the capability, she said.
Yeah. You know, there was a time in America when most police officers didn't have guns. I mean, it was
that reminds me of where I used to live.
Yeah, exactly. It was a time in the UK. And I mean, in the UK, it was in my lifetime. In the United States, it was in the late 19th century. But, you know, there was a time when most cops didn't have guns because guns were so expensive and they weren't all that, you know, continuously reliable. And there were a lot of work and hassle. And so they would say, oh, we don't have so many. I think the drones are going to go the same way. You know, it's now they're appropriating billions of bullets and millions of guns, and pretty soon it'll be the same with the drones.
See, the drones, in my imagination, getting off tack a bit here, I watch sci-fi films.
Mm-hmm.
So my drones are already armed and are autonomous.
That's coming. And let me take it a step further. They now have drones the size of dragonflies.
I know.
So,
yeah.
Anyway,
okay.
So now we know the FBI's got a drone, or has drones.
There was one right there.
Yep. Zip. Okay.
The Federal Reserve finished its two-day meeting today. Ben Bernanke, the chair, had a press conference afterwards, which is always a huge event.
Mm-hmm.
And the Federal Reserve said it's keeping its massive stimulus program intact for now, amid expectations of middling economic growth through next year. But they were a bit optimistic about the future of the recovery, hinted they expect the numbers could turn in their favor.
Mm-hmm.
They also said that they nodded to the strength of the housing market and consumer spending as drivers of the economy. The stock market wasn't enthusiastic about this. Everybody ended down about 1.25%, roughly, something like that.
Right.
They updated their economic projections. They think the economy will expand between 2.3 to 2.6% for the year, down for their March projection, but projections from 2014 are up to a growth rate of 3 to 3.5%. And they also think that the first hike in the benchmark interest rate won't come until 2015. So generally speaking, they were fairly optimistic, but Wall Street reacted poorly to it.
That's very interesting. I have a book coming out in November titled The Crash of 2016. And it will follow by about a year when the Fed says, okay, we're not going to inflate this bubble anymore, and they step back. And you just said they just said that they're going to do that in 2015. I am vindicated. Anyway.
Ooh, that's gratifying.
Yes. Okay, back to
President
you.
President Obama spoke in Berlin today on the east side of the Brandenburg Gate, and said so long as nuclear weapons exist, we are not truly safe, and said that we needed to drop our nuclear weapons stockpile by about a third from the current START treaty levels, which would bring them down from about 1550 to about between 1,000 to 1,100. The speech didn't make it clear whether this would be unilateral, and some Republicans have reacted by saying that this would be unilateral disarmament. Bob Corker, the senator who's the ranking member on the Foreign Relations Committee, expressed concern about this. Secretary of State John Kerry called him and reassured him that any disarmament would be done bilaterally,
would not be done
unilaterally.
In other words, if we do away with some of our nukes, Putin and Russia will do away with some of their nukes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
President Obama is preparing a major policy push on climate change, including for the first time, limits on greenhouse gas emissions from new and existing power plants, as well as expanded renewable energy development on public lands, and an accelerated effort on energy efficiency in buildings and equipment, according to senior officials today.
Yeah, what I thought was really interesting was what apparently what he's, if you're interpreting his remarks right, that he's saying, I don't need an act of Congress to do this, which means that the EPA has already defined carbon dioxide as a pollutant. If they were simply to say to the power plants in America, which produce about a third of all our carbon dioxide pollution, carbon dioxide is a pollutant and you are going to have to start paying for it, or reducing it, then, you know, that would go a long way. I mean, the only industry right now, if you have a mom and pop shop, if you've got a burger store and you have to pay to have somebody haul your waste away, to haul your trash away, to haul away the dead French fries and the used fat, you know. But the oil industry, nobody pays for their waste, which is carbon dioxide. They don't have to pay for it. I mean, you and I pay for it. And
right.
So if he was to simply say, okay, you guys have to pay for your own waste.
That's an interesting idea.
Yes. It's not original, but actually Denmark came up with that about 8 or 10 years ago and added, I think, about a buck to a gallon of gas to pay for the health consequences of burning gasoline. Anyhow, Victoria Jones, thank you for the news of the day.
Thank you so much.
It's great to see you. Brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Talk radio news service. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, on this program, geez, it seems like it was a year ago. I'm not sure exactly when it was. Kevin Camps was on, and he was talking about how, you know, the groundwater around Fukushima is now at risk. Well, apparently that has come to pass. Kevin Camps of Beyond Nuclear, he is the nuclear waste watchdog at beyondnuclear.org. Kevin, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. What's the current state of the, you know, what's going on? I saw this headline, this Reuters story, Japan finds highly toxic strontium 90 in Fukushima groundwater. What does this mean?
Well, it's probably the biggest crisis since the beginning of this nuclear catastrophe over 2 years ago in March of 2011. It's the fact that they continually have to use large amounts of water to keep the molten cores cool on a perpetual basis into the future. They use something like 400 tons of water per day to cool the molten cores. And so they have to store that water because it's contaminated with radioactivity. And there's an equal amount of water that is simply flooding into the basement levels of this destroyed nuclear power plant from the groundwater, which then picks up radioactive contamination. So about 800 tons of water per day is becoming radioactively contaminated. It all has to be stored. And so they've filled all the areas of the site with these water storage tanks. And obviously it is leaking because radioactive strontium, which is a seeker of bone in the human body, as well as radioactive tritium, which goes everywhere in the human body, have been found at very high levels very close to the Pacific shore, just within 100 feet of the Pacific Ocean at the site.
Wow. And so you, by seeker of bone, you mean it gets in your bones and it would cause over time bone cancer?
Yeah, it is carcinogenic. The body mistakes radioactive strontium-90 for calcium, so it just embeds in the human bone. It can cause bone cancer. Oh, it can cause leukemia.
The same way the body mistakes radioactive cesium for potassium and embeds it in muscles like the heart.
Yeah, exactly. And so at Chernobyl, the worst culprits that escaped in that catastrophe were radioactive cesium and strontium. They both have a 30-year half-life, so you got to multiply by at least 10. So that's 300 years of hazard. To be safer, 600 years of hazard. And once it gets into the ocean, it then reconcentrates. It doesn't dilute. It reconcentrates in the food chain, and humans are at the top of the food chain.
Right. And to say that in plain English, the little tiny plants, the algae absorb it, and then the algae get eaten by the little fish, and the little fish get eaten by the medium-sized fish, and the medium-sized fish get eaten by the big fish. And by the time you got a big fish like a tuna being hauled up on board, you've got probably tons and tons and tons of algae that absorb strontium that have been, you know, worked their way through the bodies of all these fish that have made this giant carnivorous fish. And then we eat it.
That's
Is that right?
And, yeah, that's exactly right. It's called bioconcentration. And the other element I mentioned, radioactive hydrogen, which is called tritium, that goes everywhere in the human body, right down to the DNA level where it does its damage. And what's really incredible is, whereas Tokyo Electric Power Company is trying to filter out some of the radioactivity from the contaminated water, you cannot filter out tritium because it is water. It's radioactive hydrogen. So that simply is left behind, even if the filtering systems work, which they're not. And the big question is, where does the tritiated water go? Tokyo Electric would like to just dump it in the ocean intentionally, and the fishermen along the coast are not letting that happen.
What is the lifespan of tritium?
I'm sorry?
What is the half-life for tritium?
It's 12.3 years, so that's about 120 years, if not 250 years of hazard.
Wow. And if it's... if it's radioactive hydrogen, I always mix up helium and hydrogen. Which one is it one or two, protons, neutrons, and electrons?
Yeah, hydrogen is number one on the periodic table.
Number one.
So it has a single proton. And
so if it's made radioactive, what does it have? A second
neutron, and then tritium has two neutrons, so it's a three-particle nucleus in the hydrogen atom.
So two neutrons, one proton, one electron.
Yeah.
And it takes 12 and a half years for that extra neutron to discharge itself, basically.
Yeah, and, you know, it's very powerful at that level in the DNA or in your cells or in your tissues. That's where it does its damage.
Yeah, a neutron flying around. Is that what's called an alpha particle? Pardon my high school science questions here. It's been a long time since I studied this.
Well, you got alpha particles, you got gamma radiation, you got neutron radiation from an ongoing chain reaction, and to be honest with you, we have another expert who handles that stuff.
He would know that stuff. So it's probably the neutron radiation because it's a neutron. So you know, but whatever. Okay, so that's what's going on with that.
Actually, the tritium is a beta emission, and it's considered a low beta emission. But when you get it into your most intimate DNA molecules,
right.
That's
yeah, because it's going to go anywhere in your body that water would, and your body's like 98% water or something. So
yeah, and there's a phenomenon called organically bound tritium where it sticks around for a very long time. You know, some of the tritium does get excreted, you know, in urine and such, but some of it binds in your tissues and it sticks around and does prolong damage.
So what's the future? I mean, TEPCO here, you're talking 800 tons of water a day to keep these cores from melting down and going nuclear. And, you know, where are they getting that water from? Where's that water going to go? how can they sustain this for more than, I mean, they've been doing it for 2 years now. That's a mind-boggling amount of water. Where are they going to put all this?
Well, there's been some amazing photos run in the New York Times, for example, that shows that the entire site is being covered in these giant steel tanks. They're very large size, and there's thousands of them at this point.
Really?
They're holding immense amounts of water. We're talking hundreds of thousands of tons of water in these tanks, which are leaking, unfortunately. That's where some of this contamination is coming from.
So there's, I mean, it sounds like there's no end game here. At Chernobyl, they covered the cores in concrete and they just said, okay, we're going to let it cook. All right, can they do that at Fukushima? Is there any way to put an end to this?
You know, it's really incredible. They have been criticized, Tokyo Electric has, for very short-term thinking. They're taking things like one day at a time. But of course, this is a decades-long, if not centuries-long crisis that they're facing. So, very little to no long-term planning. One of the things that happened at Chernobyl right away was liquid nitrogen was used to freeze the ground so that groundwater, for example, couldn't flow through the melted-down reactor core site. And at Fukushima Daiichi, they have not done that, and they're now talking about it. We're two and a half years into this crisis, and they're just now talking about perhaps we should freeze the ground to prevent groundwater from flowing through and picking up radioactivity. So long-term scenario, Tokyo Electric certainly doesn't know what to do. They're showing that by their actions.
Wow. Now, I hear from a friend of mine who's Japanese, lives in Japan, that the Japanese people are not, that there's, you know, there's a small subset who are very freaked out about this, but by and large, the level of freak out has decreased somewhat because of all these assurances from TEPCO and the government. Is that consistent with what you understand?
Well, I think there's evidence that, you know, something major has changed in the Japanese population. Certainly there have been anti-nuclear activists hard at work for decades into the past, but now, you know, a sure sign of the level of concern is that 48 of the 50 still operable reactors in Japan are simply shut down.
Right.
Because local populations will not let them restart. And in fact, there's a redoubled effort to get the two operating reactors shut down because of earthquake risks.
Uh-huh. And, that's good news. Any chance of that happening in the United States? Not the earthquake risk, we all know that, but, you know, shutting down our nuclear plants?
Well, it's been an amazing year. Four atomic reactors have shut down this year in the United States, one in Florida, one in Wisconsin, and then most recently, about 2 weeks ago, at San Onofre, California, two reactors shut down. That's the most of any year in U.S. history, actually, and there's more dominoes ready to fall.
That's great. And this is stuff you guys at Beyond Nuclear have been working on.
Yeah, and the grassroots movement across the country.
Good on you. People can get, y'all can get more information at beyondnuclear.org. Kevin Camps, the nuclear waste watchdog at Beyond Nuclear. Kevin, great talking with you.
You too, Tom.
Thanks for the update. It's always great talking with you. It's always very informative. We'll be back 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, nuclear power, no, I don't think so. What do we do as an alternative? It's your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. And Dave in Denver, Colorado, listening on KKZN, Denver's progressive voice. Hey, Dave, what's up?
I wanted to talk a little bit about the pipeline, the Exxon pipeline, and the Ogallala Aquifer. Ever hear of it?
Oh, yeah. It's the large, I believe it's the largest aquifer in the United States. It covers much of the Midwest. And
that's correct. It's under western Nebraska, western Kansas, down into the Texas Panhandle, eastern Colorado, and a bit of eastern Wyoming.
Right.
That's pretty good size.
It is.
Big underground lake.
It's one giant underground lake that supplies.
Over that area, in the summertime, you'll see these large green circles. That's center pivot irrigation, not alien invaders.
Right.
And a farmer will put a well down, pump water up, and these are big pumps. They're 50 horsepower pumps. Take a lot of power. Mm-hmm. I know this because I worked for an electric utility which takes care of the, it's actually an amalgam or cooperation of rural electric co-ops
mm-hmm.
that cover that area.
Mm-hmm.
anyway, that aquifer is used, the water is mainly used to grow food that we all eat.
Right.
Now, what they would like to do, the original routing on the Keystone XL pipeline was right across the aquifer because pipelines never leak.
Right. Right. And if you believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you. Yes. And then Nebraska objected, and so they said, okay, we'll route it around your state. But good pieces of it, I believe, are still going across the aquifer, aren't they?
No, they're not routing it around the state. They said, we'll reroute it. I haven't seen a reroute, and I don't know that if I did, I would know for sure whether it was across the aquifer.
Yeah.
But
okay.
It's, I'll tell you what, British Columbia will not let a pipeline be built across their province to go to Vancouver, where there are oil refineries with excess capacity.
Right.
That's why they want to run it down to Texas.
Right.
It would
right.
be shorter and less expensive to send it to Vancouver. The Canadians, the provinces won't allow it.
Right.
Why do we allow it?
Well, because our politicians are more easily bought off than their politicians. They don't have our Supreme Court.
I've got a question for you.
Sure.
You might ask Senator Sanders this when you talk to him on Friday. Why is Harry Reid still the majority leader?
But that question has been asked of Bernie in the past, and his answer is quite straightforward, because Harry Reid gets the majority of the votes from the Democrats in the United States Senate when, at the beginning of every other year, when they open a new legislative session, there is a vote for who the majority leader will be, and the majority of the Democrats vote for Harry Reid.
And they can't change it between start of sessions?
No. Unless they, you know, somebody wanted to impeach him or something. I mean, I suppose they probably could try to overthrow him if he was, found with some horrible, what's the old saying, a dead hooker or whatever.
But the opinion of Harry Reid is he's not much of a leader.
Well, yeah, I'm not Harry Reid's biggest fan, but I think that we all have to understand that Mitch McConnell, who seems just as mild-mannered, is actually, and the guy and the billionaires behind him are presenting to Harry Reid a united, basically an iron wall. And no matter how hard Harry punches, no matter how loud he yells, it'll make no difference. They're going to filibuster everything. Harry is seriously talking now about breaking down the filibuster with regard to presidential appointments. Keep an eye on that. Because if he pulls that off, and I think he probably will, that's going to be a really big deal. And there's not a lot of people who could put together the politics for that. But there's serious talk here in D.C. that he's going to be calling for a vote on that sometime in the next few weeks. If that happens, it's going to shake this town. So we'll see, Dave. We'll see. Dave, thanks a lot for listening in Denver to KKZN. Vicky in Napa, California, listening on our Tom Hartman app, which you can find over at the App Store. Hey, Vicky, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thank you for taking my call, and thank you for all you do. I learned so much from you, as we all do. I am calling, you read from the U.S. Patriot Act a little earlier, and in reference to what Canada wants to do with the pipeline and naming protesters to come under the terrorism definition.
Mm-hmm.
And everything you read from that U.S. Patriot Act, I was in my mind envisioning this Republican Party.
Yeah.
And I really would like somebody to explain to me why we shouldn't be calling them terrorists, because I've called my representatives repeatedly. I've even asked Senators Boxer and Feinstein, their staffers, to define for me what would constitute an enemy domestic.
Mm-hmm.
They take in their oath to protect us from.
Right.
And they have not been able to answer me.
Yeah.
And I've told them, well, I'll tell you what I think. And if this was a foreign entity that was plotting to bring down our president and our government and tearing our economy down and hurting every American, we wouldn't have any trouble knowing what to call them.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact,
and every day.
You know, Bin Laden back in 98, when he published in the New York Times, you know, his screed that he was going to come and get us. He said that he was going to bleed us dry economically. He was going to hit us in a way that we would react in a way that would take us down the same way the Soviet Union was taken down, which means Afghanistan, right? Which means that, I mean, he basically predicted how George W. Bush would respond. And that was after, you know, after he said that, that's when Bill Clinton really seriously started trying to kill him. And during the Monica impeachments, Bill Clinton, somebody, you know, he got intelligence of where bin Laden was, threw three cruise missiles into there and missed him by 15 or 20 minutes. Just barely got him, or barely missed him. And I think it was Newt. I'd have to go back and check. But one of the Republicans went to the floor of the House and said, "No, this is just Bill Clinton trying to distract us from the real crisis of Monica Lewinsky." Right, Vicki. Thanks a lot for the call. Well said.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
In the Republicans' mind, Monica Lewinsky and the phony IRS stuff, that's a real scandal. Not the fact that the American middle class has been wiped out by Reaganomics. Very, very probiotically ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com. Food for your brain, EdisonFactor.com. The good Erdem Gunduz, excuse me. I'm having a hard time reading. More commonly known as the Standing Man, this Turkish choreographer has become an icon of resistance ever since he started his unique protest earlier this week. After Turkish police expelled activists from Istanbul's Gezi Park over the weekend, Gunduz conjured up a plan to get around the government's protest regulations. Since authorities said that they would crack down on any large gatherings of people, he decided that he would stand alone. In Istanbul's Taksim Square, to call attention to the protest movement's grievances without violating Turkish law. His decision has now inspired thousands of other Turks to do the same and stand in silent opposition to the abuses of their government. Good work, Erdem. Democracy begins with people like you. The bad. Glenn Beck. During a broadcast of his radio show yesterday, the conservative pundit compared the activities of immigration activists who protested outside the home of Kansas Senator Chris Kobach to the Ku Klux Klan. Seriously, check it out.
700 protesters got into buses at a church and went to his house to protest. This is, I believe, the same exact tactics
despicable
used by the Klan in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing it in the name of civil rights.
Yeah, last time I checked, Glenn, the Ku Klux Klan's main tactics were lynching and murder and bombing churches and things. And I don't recall the Kansas protesters doing any of those things. Comparing a white supremacist group with people trying to make sure families aren't broken up by deportation isn't just inaccurate. It's wildly offensive. And the very, very ugly James Taranto. What is it about the military's sexual assault crisis that brings out the worst in conservatives? In a column for Monday's edition of the Wall Street Journal, editor James Taranto argued that Senator Claire McCaskill's decision to block the promotion of General Susan Helms after the general helped one of her commanders get clemency after a sexual assault charge was part of, quote, a war on men, a political campaign against sexual assault in the military that shows signs of becoming an effort to criminalize male sexuality, end quote. Actually, James, the only thing Senator McCaskill is trying to do is make sure that rapists are punished. If you think criminalizing male sexuality is what that's all about, then that is not just bizarre. It's very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. Bird in Ravenna. Is it Ravenna or Ravenna, Ohio?
Ravenna.
Ravenna. Hey, what's up?
Well, I was listening before to the one gentleman who was talking about, well, it was the economy and not politics.
You mean the reason why the middle class in America is 27th in the world and basically in the tank?
Right, exactly. And yeah. Actually, the term used to be political economy.
You're right.
And there's a book written by a gentleman named Barry C. Lynn called Cornered, The New Monopoly Capitalism and the Economics of Destruction.
Yeah, well, I had Barry Lynn on the program when that, I believe it was when that book came out. It was about 2-3 years ago.
About 2 years ago, I think. And I just picked it up this year and read it. And it's very intriguing because it also brings up the idea of, with these spy programs and the contractors, the shifting of government from public to private.
Right.
And in the book, of course, he talked about the fact that with the election of Reagan, the antitrust laws have basically no longer been enforced.
Yeah.
And the consolidation of the large trading companies such as Walmart and their impact on producers and on the public.
Yep. Yeah, I see these Walmart ads on TV where, you know, hi, my name is Ralph, and when you see me, I hope you see a successful person. Or those are actually kind of charming. But then there's that one where I'm a doctor, I'm a lawyer, I'm a professor, and we shop at Walmart. And then this woman, I forget which one she was, maybe the doctor or the lawyer or whatever, she says, 60% of all Americans shop at Walmart. And at that point, I'm yelling at the TV, that makes it a monopoly. It's like, you know,
that's exactly right. That's
exactly like,
right.
They're bragging about it. They're bragging about it. It's like, wait a minute. Had Teddy Roosevelt heard that 60% of Americans were consuming products from one company, he would have gone after that company on horseback.
Exactly.
So, anyhow, Bird, well said. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Kirk in Bothell, Washington. Hey, Kirk, thanks for listening to KBCS, 91.3 FM. What's up?
Hey, Tom. First of all, thanks for sharing our safe air. And
sure.
I wanted the Hartman perspective on what's going on in Brazil, first, and then secondly, Brazil and Turkey combined. I'm wondering whether you think that Brazil is sort of in its pre-Reagan revolution moment that we faced about 35 years ago, because I heard today that the government of Lula actually raised about 40 million people out of poverty into the lower middle class.
That's correct.
And from what I understand,
it's being reversed right now.
The protest is about that being taken away, that they've had a glimpse of what's possible, and now they're seeing it slip away.
Yes.
Lula's successor runs for election next year. So do you think that maybe there's a tipping point moment that can either go the Calvinist direction or hopefully the other direction?
Yeah. I genuinely don't know, Kirk. I am not that expert in either Brazilian or Turkish affairs. And in fact, we had this conversation, Louise and Sean and I believe it was yesterday morning about, it might have been even this morning, about getting on somebody who really does know what's going on in Turkey and really does know what's going on in Brazil and can inform me as well as our viewers and listeners. Because I can give you, the cursory stuff knowledge that I have, which is probably quite similar to yours because my understanding and perspective is similar to what you just said. But I can't dig much deeper than that. My focus is mostly on American politics. But I think that it's entirely possible. And with regard to Turkey, it's interesting. I got a haircut this morning. My barber is Turkish. In fact, he's so Turkish. I mean, he's like so recently Turkish that he speaks very little English. And I said, what do you think about Erdogan, about the current president? And he says he's too strong man. And I said, do you think that the people will overthrow him? And he said, election in 3 years. And I said, well, you think they're, something's going to happen before then? And he's like, I don't know. It's like go ahead.
Here's the other thing I'm wondering, Tom. I was 4 years old in 1968, but these two things sort of conflagrating within a couple weeks of each other. Do you think this is another like 1968 moment globally where, one thing leads to another and people are inspired and decide to rise up and say enough's enough.
What happened in 68? You're talking about the Summer of Love?
No, there was the attempted revolution in Czechoslovakia. There was the militant protests at the Olympics where the Black American athletes raised their fists. I mean,
yeah, in solidarity with South Africa, and Bobby Kennedy was killed. I don't know, Kirk, and I'm not sure that that was necessarily a world-changing moment or year. I don't recall it as one, and I was 17 in 68, although part of my recollection of that year had a lot to do with, you know, just local stuff that involved me rather than paying a lot of attention to the international scene. But I don't want to dig myself into a hole here by going into areas that I don't know that much about. Let me just talk again with Louise and Sean about seeing if we can track down somebody who really understands what's going on in Brazil and Turkey, and we'll dig into it. Kirk, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for raising the issue. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Hey, Steve, we got a minute to go. What's up?
Okay, I just wanted to remind you that the latest issue is that there's been 22 years of no global warming, and they always say there's 97% of the scientists agree with that, that there is global warming, but they don't tell us how many scientists there are. I know 30.
Okay, hang on just a second. Go over to Rolling Stone and read this piece by Bill McKibben. June broke or tied 3,215 high temperature records across the United States. That followed the warmest man record for the Northern Hemisphere, the 327th consecutive month in which the temperature of the entire globe exceeded the 20th century average, the odds of which occurring by simple chance are 3.7 times 10 with 99 zeros after it, a number considerably higher than all the stars in the universe. In other words, You're wrong. You're just absolutely wrong. And global warming is not only real, it's getting really, really scary and really, really dangerous. Again, Bill McKibben wrote a brilliant piece for Rolling Stone. I think it just came out today. It's called Global Warming's Terrifying New Math, Three Simple Numbers That Add Up to Global Catastrophe and That Make Clear Who the Real Enemy Is. And I strongly recommend you go over to RollingStone.com and read it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
In fact, Jim Javinsky tells me it's nearly 100 degrees in Alaska today. Amazing. Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program and Cliff in Canyon Country, California. Hey, Cliff, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Before I get to my point, yes, there are private prisons in Florida, and unfortunately, Debbie Wasserman Schultz took money from CCA.
Ouch.
A few months ago.
Yeah,
I know. It was really disappointing. But the reason I called was I just wanted to expand on the Fukushima story. Your guest didn't really mention the fact that I read a story, I think it was in Truth Out 2 weeks ago, that they have actually found radioactive plankton from the sea, from the coast of Japan all the way to Guam.
Wow.
I don't know how many hundreds or thousands of miles that is, but and I don't know the exact elements or the kind of radiation they found, but
yeah.
It was pretty scary just to read that.
Yeah, and that's the stuff that starts at the bottom of the food chain that eventually ends up as fish, which is a primary food supply for the Japanese, and a lot of that fish ends up here. And by the way, the Earth spins in a counterclockwise direction, so the oceans flow in a clockwise direction if you're looking from the North Pole, and as I recall. And so, or maybe it's the other way around. In any case, and so the ocean currents go from west to east, so Japan's water at one point is our water at some later point with regard to the Pacific. And with regard to tritium, water that evaporates carries tritium with it, and that comes down as rain. So it's like not good stuff. Cliff, thank you for the call, and thanks for pointing that out. Robert in New Smyrna Beach. I don't see the state. It kind of clipped off the end. What state again, Robert? Oh, Florida. Okay. What's up? Robert? Apparently Robert's not there. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Corky.
Would you do me a favor next time you get a guest on about this immigration issue,
mm-hmm.
and they say no health care for 13 years for immigrants?
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to pay for them when they show up at the emergency room bleeding?
You and me.
That's, call these guys out on the ridiculous. That's what you're so yeah. good at.
Well, thank you. That's, I will and I do. I mean, this that argument, by the way, doesn't just apply to people who are undocumented workers here in the United States or undocumented residents or whatever, you know, the, quote, illegal aliens in the United States. It applies to everybody. I mean, it's just crazy that there is that anybody in the United States doesn't have full access to health care, whatever they need, however much they need of it, you know, in a reasonable fashion with reasonable speed and quality at no cost, or at least as part of one of the costs of society as a whole, the way that our streets are, quote, at no cost, and our stoplights and our police and fire. I mean, you know, we all pay for them, obviously, but as part of the commons. It's just crazy that it's not. But Corky, excellent point. Thank you for bringing it up. Marcio in Pompano Beach, Florida. Hey, Marcio.
Yes. Hey, how you doing, Tom? It's a pleasure to be talking with you. I'm a Brazilian, and I've been living here for the past 12 years, but I still have a lot of contact with my family and friends back in Brazil. So I kind of understand a little bit what's going on over there right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole reason for the protests, it has to do straight up with political corruption. It's over there, it happens in a kind of different way that is over here. Corruption, political corruption over there is a much more direct type of thing, meaning the politicians actually steal money from the public coffers. So in Brazil, we have all of the social programs such as free medical care, free education, but the problem is much of that money just gets stolen by politicians.
Uh-huh.
And probably what happened right now was that Brazil was doing all of that investment in building all of those stadiums for the World Cup, plus getting all of the preparation.
Oh, that's right. That's right. The country's putting an enormous amount of money into the World Cup, getting ready for it. And they're cutting back on social programs as a consequence of that, aren't they?
Yeah, but the whole thing is not that they necessarily need to cut back on those programs. It's just that if you count the amount of money that's being stolen through corruption, just straight up corruption, like let's say a politician starts to build a stadium. A stadium is supposed to cost like $1 billion. At the end of the construction, it will end up costing $2-3 billion.
Yeah, it's like our defense contractors.
Uh-huh. So basically that was it, and get to a point that it starts to affect the population over there.
But see, what has, Marcio, do a reality check with me. Here in the United States, we have that kind of corruption in the defense industry. But nobody is yelling about it, by and large, because we're not hurt by it. But if tomorrow Congress was to come out and say, okay, we're going to cut in half long-term unemployment benefits, we're going to do away with part of the mortgage interest deduction, we're going to reduce food stamps, we're going to do all this because we have to allocate more money to the defense industry, I think then in America you might see the same kind of protests you see in Brazil. And people would then start talking about the corruption in the defense contracting industry. But we're not talking about it because we're not cutting back at least enough. We're not doing it in a really visible way like they do in Brazil. And frankly, we haven't given out the benefits in the first place that they'd given in Brazil. I mean, I know that you're right about health care and education. A friend of mine is married to a Brazilian, and she's a PhD. She's a professor at one of the universities there, and it's a very healthy and generous system.
Oh, yes, it is. But at some point, what happens is corruption has always been a problem in Brazil. Every year, probably takes like 25-30% of the whole GDP of the country just go out of the window just through corruption. I mean, I live in Miami, and I live in South Florida, so I'm always in Miami. So I get to see a lot of Brazilian politicians that come over here, they bring their money, they spend all over here buying properties and everything.
Yeah.
If
I got it. Marcio, I'm sorry we're out of time, but I get it. Thank you for the call. And, maybe we'll have to, I've got to dig into this a little more. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman program, don't forget the my favorite segment of the week, Geeky Science, and the best of the rest of the news and your calls. But don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. So go to movetoamend.org, go to pdamerica.org, get out there and go to free-don.com and do something about Don Siegelman. Tag your it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.